أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم رب اشرح لي صدري ويسر لي أمري واحلل عقدة من لساني يفقه قولي. Brothers and sisters, thank you very much for coming to this session, series of sessions that we are having to understand our religion properly. The series of lectures that I have been asked to deliver in Australia is primarily focused on understanding what exactly is jihad and how can we understand that the kind of militant approach adopted by some Muslims, which they are undertaking with a view to spread Islam and defend the cause of Islam, why is it not a correct Islamic approach? It is one thing that you make a claim that what somebody else is doing is wrong, but it is quite another that you make a clear, convincing presentation wherein you are showing from the original sources of Islam that what the understanding people are perceiving as truly Islamic understanding is not exactly correct. Problems that come to our mind when we understand the law of Itmam-e-Hujjah, application of jihad, which is universal, meant to be applicable for all times to come. There is another mention of jihad in the Quran, which was era specific, which was in actual fact the Almighty's decision to inflict punishment on the people who had rejected the message of God Almighty coming through the messenger, God's mercy be on him, clearly to a group of people who rejected it knowingly and they were punished. I described the various verses in the Quran that very clearly point at the fact that the Almighty has expected Muslims to fight against some of those non-Muslims who rejected the Almighty's message despite knowing it clearly to be from him. That jihad that was required from the companions of the Prophet, may God's mercy be on him, was meant for that time alone. Now, this claim obviously is something which needs to be clarified. There are questions that need to be answered. But what I am stating right at the outset is that this law of Itmam-e-Hujjah, that is the law that states that when a nation receives God's message from God's messengers clearly in a manner that there remains no doubt in the minds of the people who are the addressees, and yet they reject it arrogantly, they are punished by the Almighty. This law is what I'm describing as the law of Itmam-e-Hujjah, and this law is what is applicable to the immediate addressees of the messenger. Now, when you make that statement, there comes an immediate question, or call it a problem, which many Muslims feel that they don't feel comfortable with. And that question is that if what you're saying is correct, then we'll have to accept that some part of the Quran is not applicable practically for all times to come, which many Muslims think is a huge difficulty in accepting this point of view. So I will make an attempt in this particular session to show to you that the Quran itself is informing us that some part of it indeed is practically not applicable for all times to come. It was meant for only the times when it was revealed. Obviously, when you have two different points of view and you've got to choose one of them as the one that you would espouse, you would accept, you've got to consider the arguments of both sides and which of the two presentations or more than two presentations makes more sense to you is the one that you ought to accept. But before I mention some arguments from the Quran, I would just like to mention briefly the fact that when we make an attempt to understand Islam, when we make an effort to understand the Quran, there could be three approaches, broad approaches of understanding possible. One approach could be, which I am describing as the traditional approach. According to this approach, if you want to interpret the Quran or Hadith, there is only one acceptable way. And that way is that you justify your understanding by giving supporting statements and evidences from some earlier scholars. If you are presenting something which is completely new, we're not going to take it seriously because it ought to be supported by our tradition. This is what I describe as the traditional understanding or the traditional way of interpreting the Quran and Hadith. There is another approach which is called the modernist approach, according to which no interpretation of Quran and Hadith is acceptable which runs contrary to the modern understanding of what truth and reality is. In other words, if there is a scientific truth, there is a truth in social sciences, universally accepted now, then the Quran and Hadith must give a meaning which is consistent with that understanding. This is what I call the modernist approach. There is a third approach of which I have not been able to come up with an appropriate expression to describe it. But in the absence of a better expression, I'm calling it the textualist approach. According to the textualist approach, the understanding that is the right understanding of Islam, of the Quran and Hadith, is the one which is diligently, honestly making an attempt to explain the text of the Quran through its words and through its context. And the reader or the listener is made to understand that the meanings that are being presented are exactly what the text is saying. Questions are answered, the doubts are removed, and the focus of both the presenter and the addressees is to see as to whether the text seems to be saying exactly what has been explained. And you're not imposing on the text anything from the outside. My humble claim is that we are following the textual approach. And in the process, when we come to certain conclusions, which, by the way, can always be wrong, because it's a human effort at understanding the Quran and Hadith, it can always have flaws, which obviously have to be discussed, pointed out, and if there is anything clear that emerges, adjustments should be made and corrections should be done. However, if once you are satisfied that the text is saying something clearly, that is what God is telling us. even if nobody else has said it before, even if it runs contrary to the modern understanding of what the truth is. So, with that clarification, now I am going to present before you a few verses which, apart from the verses of jihad, to me are clarifying that some verses of the Quran were meant only for the time when it was revealed, and they cannot be in any way shown to be applicable for other times. In other words, what I'm trying to say is that our claim that there is a part of jihad, there is one category of jihad mentioned in the Quran which was only meant for the times, for the time era when it was revealed in, we are justified in making that claim because there are other verses in the Quran too which likewise clearly are meant for those times alone. What I am claiming is that if I am able to present one verse of the Quran which very clearly is giving us an understanding that this verse and the expectation of this verse cannot be extended to any period beyond a certain period, that is immediately after the life of the Prophet, may God's mercy be on him, then I have made my point. Then I have done my job. At least the door for discussion is open that the Quran, some part of it applies to the times when it was revealed and some part of it applies for until the day of judgment. Which part belongs to which category is obviously something which is a matter of discussion and debate. The first verse that I'm presenting to bring home my point is verse 53 of Surah Al-Ahzab, Surah number 33. The verse is stating that the Prophet, may God's mercy be on him, is God's messenger and believers have to show respect to him and to his family. The Quran says, مَا كَانَ لَكُمْ مَنْ تُوزُوا رَسُولَ اللَّهِ. It is not allowed befitting that you cause to the messenger of God harm and pain. وَلَا أَن تَنْكِحُوا أَزْوَاجَهُ مِنْ بَعْدِهِ أَبَدًا. Nor are you allowed to marry any of his wives after him at all, ever. This is a clear expectation, an injunction, a law that the Almighty has mentioned. And most clearly, the practical application of this law was only valid until such time that the last widow of the Prophet was alive. After she died, there is no application of this verse that can be imaginable. And yet the verse is here in the Quran for us to recite for all times to come. So this verse alone is a clear proof of the reality that the Quran carries instructions, guidance, God's expectations, some of which cannot be applied to the present times. But let's move on. There is another expectation of the Almighty, which by its nature is such that although it's there, very clearly written, but I can tell you that it is not followed now anymore. And you don't find any scholar making a statement that why is it that this verse is not being followed. It's a verse in Surah Al-Anfal, the 8th surah chapter of the Quran, verse 41, which says that when you fight a battle and the enemy leaves behind assets or weapons, what we call spoils of war, then the spoils of war have got to be distributed in a certain manner which has been described in detail. So the Quran says, وَعْلَمُوا أَنَّمَا غَنِمْتُمْ مِنْ شَيْءٍ فَانَّ لِلَّهِ خُمُسَهُ إِلَىٰ آخِرٍ, that be absolutely sure that whatever spoils of war you get, then those spoils of war, one-fifth of those spoils of war are meant for God, and the rest are to be distributed amongst the soldiers. Now, what we have are standing armies. We have armed forces who are provided with salaries, amenities all throughout their stay as official representatives of the armed forces. And therefore, when a war takes place and the enemy runs away, leaving behind whatever tanks and other artillery and weapons of war, nobody says that they have to be distributed amongst the soldiers. Why? Because the expectation of the distribution of spoils of war was meant for the time where people used to voluntarily opt for entering into the battlefield for doing jihad. They otherwise were doing their own businesses and whatever other ways of earning they used to go for. So the law of distribution of spoils of war is still there in the Quran, but it is not applied, and nobody is worried about it, because it's quite obviously understood that it was meant for a particular era. It is meant for a particular situation. If the situation is going to be there, it's going to apply. But if it is not going to be there, it's not going to apply. Then we move on. And I give another example of Surah An-Nisa, fourth Surah of the Quran. And the verse is 102. The Almighty is mentioning a situation wherein believers are proceeding for jihad, and they are led by the Messenger of God, may God's mercy be on him. And there comes a time when prayers are got to be said. Now the Almighty is mentioning that when that situation arises, I mean, imagine quite obviously, no believer would be willing to not pray behind the Messenger. I mean, he being there, you are a part of, the group who have proceeded for jihad, and in comes the time of Zuhr or Asr or any prayer, and the Prophet, may God's mercy be on him, is leading that prayer. Everybody would want that they should be a part of the congregational prayer. So the Quran describes in considerable detail, one verse, the manner this situation is to be handled, whereby on the one hand, believers are praying behind the Prophet, and on the other hand, the security situation is being taken care of. So the Almighty has mentioned the fact that half of the believers should stay back, while the other half are praying before behind the Prophet. And when they are finished with their prayers, they would get back and allow the other people who were standing behind as their guards to join the Prophet for prayer. It is a prayer that you would not find said now ever. Why? Because it was meant only for the time when the Messenger was there, and everybody wanted to be a part of the congregational prayer which was led by the Prophet. Now that he is no more with us, this situation would never arise, because there is nobody else other than him who has the same status as he enjoyed, whereby everybody wanted desperately to say prayers behind him, he being the Imam. So the Quran says, وَإِذَا كُنْتَ فِيهِمْ فَأَقَمْتَ لَهُمُ الصَّلَاةِ. And O Prophet, when you are with them, then you say prayers, lead prayers in this manner. This, as I said, is not applicable anymore, But it is very much a part of the Quranic text which you and I recite even today. There is another verse in the Quran in Surah Al-Mujadila, Surah number 58, verses 12 and 13, which are essentially saying, these verses, that there was a time when there were people, more particularly hypocrites, who would just waste the time of the Prophet, may God's mercy be on him, and ask him to spare some moments for them to talk to him exclusively. This obviously was something which was disturbing for the Prophet, because he had many other important things to do, and more significantly, the people who really wanted to have that opportunity to be given to them were not serious-minded people. They were not the ones who were asking any real, genuine questions about religion. They just wanted to waste his time and to cause him problems and pain. So the Almighty imposed a condition whereby the person who was to talk to him, in seclusion, was to first spend something in the way of God and then come. So it was kind of a deterrent, because the people who were hypocrites would never have done it, because they were not interested in the Almighty's message. So Surah 58, Al-Mujadila, verses 12 and 13 are actually referring to that law that the Almighty mentioned. In verse 12, that expectation and requirement has been mentioned. And in verse 13, after a certain while, the Almighty has removed that expectation. Which again points to the fact that there were some verses, some passages in the Quran, which most certainly and clearly were meant for the times when they were revealed, and they've got nothing to do with the present times. Last but not the least, I'm now presenting another example which quite often creates difficulties for some of us while we talk to, more particularly, the non-Muslims about Islam. Well, we also sometimes have this question in our mind. And the question is, why is it that we find in the Quran a mention, not just once, but in many passages, of the fact that there could be slaves and slave girls? It is mentioned in a way that you find that it's a normal part of the life that the Quran is describing. So, for example, the Quran mentions in Surah 23, Al-Mu'minun, verses 5 and 6, describing the attributes of good believers. Qad aflaha al-mu'minun. That's how it starts. And it mentions one of the attributes of the believers as وَالَّذِينَ هُمْ لِفُرُوجِهِمْ حَافِظُونَ. They are very mindful of their chastity. They remain chaste. إِلَّا عَلَىٰ أَزْوَاجِهِمْ أَوْ مَا مَلَكَتْ أَيْمَانُهُمْ. Except for their wives and their slave girls. فَإِنَّهُمْ غَيْرُ مَلُومِينَ. Because if they do with them, then they are not to be blamed. So you know that there are quite a few Muslims even today who say that it is very much a possibility, and as and when we get the opportunity of waging a war against the non-Muslims and make them prisoners of war, their ladies will make them our slave girls. Well, there are quite a few others who have gone as far as actually doing it even now. But the question is that is it still applicable? Obviously, if it is, let's make that claim confidently. But if it is not, then let's know why it is not. Well, the explanation that I am making is that slavery was neither created, introduced, nor was promoted by Islam, by the Quran. The institution of slavery was in existence when the Quran started getting revealed. And the Almighty dealt with the problem of slavery in a manner that he did not eliminate slavery immediately, overnight, by one stroke of pen. but removed slavery from the society gradually, as indeed has been the Almighty's policy with regard to most of the evils, vices, which were prevalent in the society in a manner that it was deep-rooted and people were so influenced by the evils that it wouldn't have been possible for them to get rid of them immediately. You know, a case in point is the prohibition of alcoholic drinks. I mean, the Almighty didn't outlaw, prohibit those drinks immediately after the revelation started or immediately after the migration. Likewise was the case of slavery. That is, the Almighty got rid of it and got rid of it gradually. But while it was still there, he mentioned it as one of the possibilities because that was something that the society already accepted. And while the ultimate prohibition didn't come, obviously, what was already in existence had to be retained. But the two types of verses are there. And those people who make a very strong claim that each and every verse of the Quran is meant to be applied for all times to come, make a statement that, look here, there is a mention, positive mention of slavery, or at least there is a permission that we see of having a relationship with slave girls. So, what's wrong with it? Now, what I'm saying is that right from the beginning, the Quran mentioned slavery in a manner, in a tone, that it was absolutely clear that the Almighty doesn't like it. So, Surah Balad is one of the earliest surahs that was revealed. The 90th surah in its present, you know, marshalling, sequencing of the Quran. This surah is talking about the virtues, the good deeds, which if people would go for, they will come close to genuine faith. You know, it's one of the principles that the Almighty mentions, that if you want to acquire true faith, you've got to be good humans. You cannot be a good believer if you are not a good human being. If you're not good at heart, genuinely, true faith, which is the ultimate icing on the cake, is not what is going to enter your heart. So the Almighty is mentioning that the reason why some people do not come to close to faith is that they are unable to go for the challenge of the ascent, the rise, the challenge whereby certain things which are difficult, they are unable to do them. So this is what God is mentioning in Surah Al-Balad, but he did not brave the ascent. He was unable to take up the challenge. And what will explain to you what the ascent is? How would you know? Mal Aqaba. And the first thing that the Almighty mentions about the ascent is that those difficult things which are good but are tough, and therefore people don't go for them, and therefore they are not able to acquire true, genuine piety, and therefore they don't come close to real faith. What is that ascent? The first thing, the first expectation the Almighty mentions is Fakku Raqaba, freeing of slaves. You know what it means? What it means is that God wants you to free slaves. Had it been the intent of the Almighty to continue and preserve the institution of slavery and to promote its cause, this probably would have been a contradiction. But right from the beginning, the Almighty says that free them, emancipate them. It doesn't make sense. It's unfair. So free them voluntarily. However, as I said, so long as there were slaves and slave girls, and the final verdict didn't come, he sent rules which were applicable to them as well. Why did he not send his final expectation to get rid of slavery? Well, probably because had he done it, it would have caused harm to the very slaves and slave girls whose betterment and the protection of whose rights was the purpose. Why? Because the arrangements were not in place to make sure that those slaves and slave girls who were going to be freed would be accommodated. Had they been freed overnight, they probably would have been reduced to beggars and even prostitutes. So, it was first that there was way paved for their freedom. And then, ultimately, their freedom was announced. Where was it announced? Well, in verse 33, chapter 24, Surah An-Nur, it has been mentioned. And quite often I find, you know, educated Muslims saying, where has it been announced? I mean, you know, they say that there is no clear injunction. I think there's a problem in the manner we read the Quran. In verse 33 of Surah An-Nur, the Almighty is saying that those people, those slaves and slave girls who approach you for the purpose of entering into a deal with you as their masters, so that they make a payment and you free them as a consequence, فَكَاتِبُوهُمْ, then you enter into that deal. You make that contract with them. Provided if you find them able to live independently. إِنْ عَلِمْتُمْ فِيهِمْ خَيْرًا. That is, if they are able-bodied, they can live independently, and they ask you to get them freed, for them to then compensate you with the amount that they owe you because they had a price, just go for it. This is an injunction which is in the Quran, and according to some outstanding scholars, it is binding on every master who was thus approached. This was one of the measures, and the other measure is mentioned in Surah Muhammad, verse 4, which says that when you fight against the enemy and you make them prisoners of war, فَإِمَّا مَنَّمْ بَعْدُ وَإِمَّا فِدَانَ, that is, either you free them without asking for any compensation, or you free them by demanding some fidya, some payment. The third possibility, which was the norm in those days, that you make them prisoners of war and then your slaves or slave girls, has been eliminated. Two possibilities mentioned. Either you free them without asking for any compensation, or you free them by asking for a compensation. So, what I'm saying is that the Almighty eliminated slavery by ensuring that no new slaves and slave girls are going to be made, and by ensuring that those who were already in existence, they are provided with the opportunity, with the option of getting freed by demanding their freedom from their masters, and those masters who would be thus approached will be bound to concede that they are going to be given freedom immediately. But what you find is that there is a mention, time and again you find in the Quranic passages, of slaves and slave girls in a manner that they are a normal part of the system, of the life that the Muslims were leading. And there were no strong negative remarks mentioned with regard to slavery in those passages. That again is an indication of the fact that in the Quran, you find verses which were meant for a specific period. And when you understand the Quran properly, then you know that if, when the period is over, then we'll still recite them, but they're not going to be applied practically anymore. So what I'm saying is that the Quran, the claim that the Quran is universal, its message is for the entire humanity and for all times to come, that claim is absolutely correct. It's absolutely clear from the Quran. But it doesn't accompany necessarily the fact that whatever injunctions, do's and don'ts are mentioned in the Quran all of them, with no exception, are applicable for all times to come. The fact is that the Quran has itself never claimed that that's what the truth is. You find expressions in the Quran like, it is zikra lil alameen. It's a reminder for the entire mankind. You find expressions like, lil alameena nazira. It's a book which is a warning for the entire mankind that there is going to come a day when everybody is going to be held accountable. There is mention in the Quran that the Quran and the Messenger are rahmatul lil alameen. They are a mercy for the entire mankind, in that the entire mankind is the addressee of the Quran, and if they accept it, it's going to turn out to be a mercy for them from the Almighty. But it doesn't say anywhere that each and every part of the expectation that is mentioned in the Quran is to be followed by everyone for all times to come. I mean, it is honestly, it's a common sense understanding. I mean, if I find that the Quran is urging me to be good to my parents, and my parents have died, what should I do? I mean, it doesn't apply to me. If somebody sees that, you know, there is a mention in the Quran that the children have to be taken care of properly, and the person doesn't have kids, so what is he going to do? Well, you know, you have injunctions which we know apply as and when there is a reason for it. There is an occasion for it. If there is no occasion, if the reasons are not there, then it's not applicable anymore, or at least not applicable for those individuals. Now, two questions remain. One is, what then is the Quran if its injunctions, all of them, are not meant for the entire mankind for all times to come? Well, the Quran is from A to Z the description of the prophetic mission through which the Messenger of God, may God's mercy be on him, was able to ensure that he was able to warn his immediate addressees in a manner that they were left with no choice but to accept. And when they rejected, they were punished by the Almighty in this very life. The entire Quran is a description of that era. It's a saga, it's a story of that mention, completely. However, some part of the Quran most certainly is applicable to us, a good part of it, and it is applicable to us practically. The last question briefly answered is, how can we distinguish between the verses that apply for all times to come and the ones that were meant for the era when it was revealed? Well, by looking at those verses, the context, the understanding, by discussing, by understanding, by talking to each other, by being fair in our analysis. I have given you some examples. There could be other examples as well. We can disagree in some of those understanding of some of those verses. But let me say at the end, it would be very unfair to make a principle which the Quran itself is not stating and impose it on the Quran and then read the Quran. I can tell you that if you will do it, then you will not be able to understand the Quran properly, because let the Quran speak itself. Let the Quran say what the principle of understanding it is, rather than create a principle on your own, make it so emotionally, communicate it to others that people stop understanding the Quran the way the Quran is presenting itself, and then you come up with interpretations which are going to be flawed, which are going to be problematic, and which are going to cause a lot of harm to the image of the Quran and Islam. May the Almighty enable us to understand the Quran properly.